Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here again with
Scott Tobias.
Keith Phipps.
Genevieve Kosky is on vacation, but she will totally be back soon because we absolutely did not slaughter her and feed her to our pet basement cannibals. Speaking of basement cannibals, in the first half of this conversation, we talked about The People Under the Stairs, the 1991 film that brought horror director Wes Craven back to overt political metaphor and made racial inequity and prejudice an open topic of discussion. That same sort of overt political metaphor hangs heavily over Get Out, the feature directorial debut of Jordan Peele, half of the comedy pairing of Key and Peele. I cannot emphasize this enough. If you have not seen this film yet, you should really turn off this podcast and go watch it. The best way to walk into this film is with no specifics about exactly how it addresses racial conflict or where the story is going. Even more than most films, it's a discovery movie where the question hanging in the air is whether Chris, the black protagonist played by Daniel Kaluuya, is just being paranoid when he thinks there's something strange going on with the rich, friendly parents of his new white girlfriend. The film keeps us close to his point of view as he navigates their lush lifestyle and a form of friendliness that always seems a little dangerous, especially when he meets their strangely artificial, emotionally removed black housekeeper and groundskeeper. Get Out builds up an incredible tension as the viewers squirm over all the embarrassing, awkward ways white liberals Dean and Missy, played by Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener, try to show their non-racist bona fides. It's almost a relief when it turns into an actual full-on horror movie instead of a film about social awkwardness. But then there's a lot more discomfort to navigate, including the directions the story seems to be going towards the end, and the way all Chris's racial fears turn out to be true.
So you guys coming up from the city?
Yeah, we're just heading up for the weekend.
Can I see your license, please?
He wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Call me Dean and you're hungry, my man.
So how long has this been going on, this thing? We hired Georgina and Walter to help care for my parents. When they died, I couldn't bear to let them go.
Do you smoke in front of my daughter?
I'm gonna quit.
She'd take care of that for you.
How?
Hypnosis.
I'm good, actually.
You ready for this?
I'm begging to be.
So look, I go do my research. Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb.
But it's cool.
Bro, how you not scared of this, man?
Couldn't see no brother around here. Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here. Get out.
Sorry, man.
Get out! Yo!
Rose, we gotta go.
Is everything okay?
Rose, the keys. Just get the keys.
I don't know where they are.
Rose!
Sink into the floor.
Wait.
Sink.
Terrible thing to waste. If there's too many white people, I get nervous.
All right, guys, tell me that you loved Get Out as much as I did, or Get Out.
I liked it a lot, but I'm going to agree with you completely when you say that it was almost a relief when it turns into a full-on horror film instead of a film about social awkwardness, because good Lord, the first, 30, 40 minutes of this film, I really just wanted to crawl under my seat. And I mean that in a great way, but just, oh boy, the shudder of recognition within myself and also within certain members of my family. Just the whole thing felt like just a shot that was aimed right in my head. And I appreciated the film greatly for that. I deserved the zinging.
It's played in so many ways that it just feel taken from life, from the really brilliantly executed encounter with the highway patrolman early on after they hit a deer, to the specifics of the way all the white characters try to talk about race in a really enlightened way that just exposes their underlying racism. And one after the other, each one a little more uncomfortable than the last. That party scene is amazing and rough.
The thing that really just killed me was Bradley Whitford talking about to him about how Obama is like the best president of his lifetime. It's just like, oh man, this is too much for me. But so Tasha, but you love this film. We're just chatting away here. You haven't
said a word. I love this film. I mean, I loved it for the degree to which it made me feel. I mean, I felt so in the skin of this character, and it was such a cringy skin. I guess, like listening to you talk about it, I realize, I guess well, the penny hadn't fully dropped for me, but the reason it's a relief when it becomes a flat-out horror film is suddenly there's action that can be taken. You know, when he's in these incredibly awkward conversations with these seemingly well-meaning white folks who just keep throwing microaggressions at him, who just keep trying to compliment him in the most insulting ways possible, or trying to assure him that they're great people by kind of bringing up what awkward people they are. There's really nothing he can do except smile awkwardly. And he's an awkward smiler. I mean, he spends so much of this movie kind of trying to gently defer people, go along with whatever they want, agree with them. He's a very passive character, which Jordan Peele has said is a very, very deliberate thing.
Yeah, Kalu is so good too, because he's such an expressive actor without saying that much. You get the feeling this is someone who's really learned the value of, I could say something here, but it's not going to get me anything except more awkwardness. So I'm just going to smile and go along. Not because I don't know any better. It's just, you know, what is to be gained by pushing this exchange any further?
And there are a bunch of different layers to that. I mean, when he pulls that move, when the white patrolman asks him for his ID, he's doing it because we're living in a country and he's currently traveling in an area where he doesn't want to be seen as an aggressor against a policeman who could shoot him. When he pulls the same thing with his girlfriend's parents, it's because he wants to maintain his relationship with her. And it just becomes kind of another layer on top of the discomfort that we all can potentially feel around the parents of like a new girlfriend, a new boyfriend, people that we sort of feel like we have to impress but might really want to get away from.
And this really feels to me like the first true Obama horror film. I mean, we talked about The People Under the Stairs reflecting the Reagan era. I mean, this is a story about Jordan Peele, like Obama, is biracial, is used to having to navigate this world, and is so insightful about what that means. And I couldn't help but think of things like, if you recall, before Obama made Joe Biden his vice president, Joe Biden said a few things that were racially a little bit off. And it was something that Obama was able to kind of absorb and forgive and look past a little bit. And you can see that impulse in Chris so much in the first half of the film, like you said, with his encounter with the police officer, for example. But in many of these exchanges of knowing that it's not going to be such a good idea for him to push it and to really just be walking on eggshells all the time. I mean, what was the Obama presidency but just trying to educate the country on race and really having to be perfect in order to do it? There was never a moment where Obama could be as brazen as a white president could, or certainly as a Trump.
It's almost like you need some kind of anger translator to convey this.
Yeah, that's right.
Jordan Peele's been very specific about the fact that this movie's been percolating for him for a while, and it kind of first percolated up when Obama was first elected, and he looked around him and saw that there were specifically liberal white elites who felt that racism had been solved. You know, it was over. We're fine now. Everything's great. We can all get along.
Did it, guys.
Congratulations, mission accomplished, giant banner on the back of the country. So that's kind of where he's coming from here. And of course, he's being interviewed a lot right now about how this movie plays for the Trump era. And he kind of admits that it's not pitched at the Trump era. It's pitched at the Obama era. It's an idea that doesn't entirely suit the moment, because he was not anticipating this moment when he made the film.
Yeah, the other branch of this, which we see less of, but we see very memorably in the opening scene, and hey, another gimp suit, was the son Jeremy, who is I guess you can't call him a serial killer, since he doesn't kill his victims, but a serial assaulter of black men and women, who just beats the first person we see in the movie and surfaces later in the movie for his nefarious purposes. So there is the overtly racist branch of the family, but then there is the branch that is maybe not even aware of their racism in some ways, which makes them all the more creepy.
That's something that I was really curious to hear your reactions on. When Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener's characters are talking up their family's history with Jesse Owens or how much they want to do to vote for Obama for a third term or whatever it is that they're saying, is any of that just a cover for their racism, their expectations that, you know, they have the right to own black bodies, that black people aren't really people to them so much as fodder? Or do they really believe all of that stuff, which kind of makes it worse because they're hypocrites?
I think both are true. I think it's a film in many ways about, in some ways, the inescapability of white privilege if you're white, is that they can, you know, profess these liberal views while also knowing that they have nothing to lose by professing these liberal views because they have all the privileges of any other white person, and they can do this as well. I think that's part of why the movie works as well as it does. I also like that it's uncompromising and that it really would have been easy to throw in a white buddy for Chris to sort of defuse the situation and say, they're not all like that, you know? And I don't really feel that the movie is professing that, but it doesn't give itself an easy out either. And I think that's a very daring move.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right in that they do have that level of comfort where they can profess liberal beliefs, but not really have a lot personally at stake in the way things kind of go, which is maybe something else we're going to learn in the Trump era.
Yeah, when you talk about how daring it is, I admire Peele so much for not caviling on these points, not compromising, not trying to like back down and stick a not all white people in there. I mean, this is a pretty uncompromising film where all of the white characters are basically irredeemably evil, and he uses that to amazing effect. And I love the fact that he doesn't compromise that and try to get in a "but we can all get along" kind of message to it. I mean, I think that makes it just so much more interesting and effective a statement.
I also liked how there's some fairly hoary devices in this that are made effective. Like the whole hypnotism thing is sort of a horror staple going back to the 1930s. But the way it's filmed is really quite effective. The way he visualizes the sunken place, that the sort of the hypnotized state that Chris sinks into, it was really quite unsettling. It reminded me of Phantasm, where all of a sudden you just have these surreal visuals out of what's been a very recognizably real world grounded film.
Though I will say there is just one really bad plot device,
which is
the box of pictures, so we can find out what happened to all of the other black men that she's brought. I mean, come on! Like the door is like open. It's just like it was such a screenwriter's convenience. Like, we need this information out there. Let us provide an actual literal door to get to that information.
And it did get your favorite thing. Also, it's like, oh yeah, cell reception is really bad out here. We can just get one of those in there.
Yeah,
well,
I like how it's though just at least for much of the film they're deliberately keeping the phone from being charged,
right?
Which is clever.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I don't remember a cell reception as bad.
No, I was referring to that. It just sort of like that
the unplugged thing.
The general horror films have to figure out a way that they're
sure. But I feel like this is the unplugged thing is especially clever because they foreground it so often. It's not a it's not a throwaway thing at the beginning of the movie where they're like, oh, cell reception is bad. They make him really uncomfortable with it. And it's one of so many tiny little things that's like, how much can you vociferously object to the fact that your phone got unplugged? You will look like an asshole if you make too much of a deal out of it. But it really is a problem. You know, somebody's touching his property. Somebody is controlling his access to the world. Somebody is, you know, threatening the only communication that he has with somebody that he trusts that cares about him. And it becomes more and more of a like a feeling of aggression tied to what is like such a small thing. One of the things I loved most about this movie is that for me, it feels so tight. There are so many little tiny things that when they initially happened, I was like, oh, that's interesting. That's neat. And then it pays off. And I sort of responded with, you know, okay, there's the payoff. And then it came up again, like in a smarter way. It's a really well-built script over time. And for me, the biggest example of that is they hit the deer. There's the business with the cop. You think that the business with the cop is going to pay off with the cop being the person who shows up in the car at the end, mm-hmm. and it's going to go in a Night of the Living Dead direction. But the part with the deer is there to remind him of how his mother died. The part with his mother dying is there to establish that nervous habit he has of clawing at chairs. The nervous habit he has of clawing at chairs is what leads to his rescue. But the fact that his mother died from being hit by a car also leads him to take his grandmother, the grandmother, into the car, which endangers him. It's just this spider web of thought through connections. Mm-hmm. So many horror films are just this like A, B, C, D kind of checklist of thing happens, thing happens, thing happens. Here, we keep coming around in a circle back to points that we've already established, and it makes him feel like a real character living in a real world.
And as you pointed out after the screening, too, is that in exchange with the cop – takes on new meaning when you realize that Allison Williams' character is running interference for reasons beyond trying to protect her boyfriend. He won't be on the police record that way, mm-hmm. as well. That's your brilliant observation, not mine. But yeah, that's another way. It is very clever. This is not a lazily constructed film.
By my brilliant observation, we should point out that it is my husband's brilliant observation. Right. He's actually in the room producing the podcast, and so he might just turn down my mic to nothing if I let him, if I let you get away with giving me the credit for that.
Yeah, Bob's doing a great job.
Oh man, cell phone reception is really bad in this studio for some reason.
I will say I need to note a couple of things because I like the film a lot, stem to stern or whatever, but the beginning of the movie, that first 40 minutes is what I like the most before we find out it's the Stepford Wives, basically. Mm-hmm. The opening sequence is so smart. I mean, you really just know you're in great hands with that because conceptually it's wonderful. It's like, oh, I'm in the wrong neighborhood. And that's a scene that we've seen played in racially reversed way 1,000 times. And just mm-hmm. to have that, you just have to do just one little twist and it just makes it play. And it's very stylish too. It really kind of establishes mood really well and gives you a sense that Jordan Peele knows what he's doing behind the camera as well. That it's not just, you can always count on Key and Peele to come up with, you know, brilliant conceits. I mean, they did that over and over again in the sketch comedy show, but it is, I think, especially for a first-time filmmaker, pretty confidently directed. The other thing I like too about the film is how this situation is signaled to be a very, very bad one for Chris immediately. Just the fact that she hasn't told her parents that she has a black boyfriend and that he's going on this trip and he's nervous about it and his friend's like, oh my God, this is terrible. I think it's just, again, it's a film that's so full of insight. It almost doesn't need to be a horror film. I'm perfectly happy that it is, but if it's based on anything, it's based on satire.
Here's the thing. I think anybody who listened to the first half of this podcast and listened to us hand-wringing about Trump is perhaps aware that we are the liberal white elites that are being skewered in this movie, that we all kind of self-identify that way. And part of being a liberal white elite, I think, is coming with a certain amount of white guilt, of racial guilt. So I think we're particularly primed to watch this movie and go, oh God, is that me? That might be me. Oh God, is that what it feels like to be faced with me and to like cringe along with Chris and identify with him really, really closely? And one of the things I found myself wondering throughout this film is, Black viewers are going to experience this differently. White viewers who don't have white liberal guilt are going to experience this very differently. People who are racist are going to experience this film extremely differently. And the special snowflakes who are out there right now knee-jerk reacting to anything liberal they see in the world and screaming at it as some sort of like bastion of how dare people have feelings are probably not going to see this movie, but if they are, they're going to walk out 5 minutes into it. I find myself incredibly curious how people, and this is the problem with being in a room with a bunch of like educated white people from roughly similar backgrounds. I really want to know how a lot of other people are seeing this film.
You see with the crowd though, it played really well when we saw it. Like you could just feel the crowd. It had the viewers kind of locked in. And that's because it works effectively as a horror movie. Although I think as Scott was about to say, I'm not sure the action in the end is as staged as grippingly as it perhaps could be. You know, I think that maybe it's
it doesn't get better than the first sequence cinematically.
Right.
Yeah.
But no, it's nothing to sneeze at either. I mean, I feel like this is Peel arriving as this is not someone who's dabbling in writing and directing a horror movie. He knows what he's doing.
No, and he said he's got another 4 horror scripts that he wrote that he couldn't get made before this. And I want to see every one of them.
Well, it was a huge hit, too. So we'll see it.
Well, and the nice thing, too, is I think generationally, younger people now, you know, get it a little bit more, right?
I hope so.
You hope so, right? Just to maybe a little usher in the post-racial world that we thought was ushered in. We didn't think that, really. But you know what I'm saying? Like, just
and for paving the way for that, you're welcome.
You're welcome.
Okay. Yeah. Oh my gosh. God. And one thing I have to kind of bring it back to in terms of it being an Obama movie was, as much as Peele was talking about white liberals feeling like racism was solved by Barack Obama's election, I think we all can remember feeling extraordinarily crestfallen by election night when Trump won and finding it just inconceivable that this is what the country is. And you saw a lot of people of color say, yeah, this is not surprising to me in the same way it is to you. This is not disillusioning. This is the way it is. And, you know, this is a film, the type of film that really, I think, understands that intrinsically.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a film that's very deeply entrenched in the Black experience of the world. Like so much of Key and Peele's comedy, it takes the Black experience as a language. And I feel like to some degree, it helps you learn to speak that language over the course of that first 40 minutes or so. And I mean, that in and of itself is, it's like a great service. Before we move on, I think we have to take a moment to call out the character of Rod, played by Lil Ray Howery, who functions as a sort of lifeline and comedy relief throughout the first half or so of the movie. He takes on a different role as the film progresses. But this is a really comic element that there were times when I didn't quite think it worked because, first of all, the comedy is so loose compared to the tautness of all of the terrifying stuff. Mm-hmm. There are points where, especially when he's talking about Jeffrey Dahmer, where it really does seem like a typical comedy movie where you just let the guy riff and like cut out the funniest stuff to put in the movie. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I really appreciated coming down from this level of incredible tension. And I appreciated Chris kind of having this like outside voice that he could speak to, who did understand his language, who was part of his culture, who he could reach out to and say, am I crazy? Like, are these things a bad things? Are they weird things? Or is it just me? And he could get an answer reflecting his own experience.
And when he loses that, the film gets even more tense. Mm-hmm. When that connection is broken is when you realize he's really in the stew pretty deeply.
Yeah. And of course, whenever he tries to turn to, you know, another African-American who is near him, it's someone who has been brainwashed and who he can't relate to at all.
Oh, my God. The performances of the man and the woman that played the groundskeeper and the housekeeper, Walter and Georgina, Marcus Henderson and Betty Gabriel.
Betty Gabriel especially. Holy crap.
Oh, they are uncanny. And they're meant to be uncanny, but they're so effectively uncanny. I loved the performances in this film. Mm-hmm. Just, I think this is an incredible use of Catherine Keener in particular, but also Bradley Whitford, who kind of strongly recalls his Cabin in the Woods character.
Yeah.
We've already talked about Daniel Kaluuya's role, and I enjoyed Allison Williams a lot, too. I spent the whole movie wondering which side she was on and being confident that the movie could take it in either direction. It would be a comfortable surprise. I really like this movie, guys.
Yeah, me too.
Well, we'll be right back after this break to talk more about Get Out and about The People Under the Stairs and how those two films relate to each other.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I got hypnotized last night.
Nigga, get the fuck out of here.
Yo, to quit smoking. But it was Rose's mom's a psychiatrist, so.
Bruh, I don't care if the bitch is Ayanna Van Zant, okay? She can't fix my motherfucking life. You ain't getting in my head.
I know she called me off guard, right? But it's cool, because I'm cured. It worked.
Bruh, how you not scared of this, man? Look, they could have made you do all types of stupid shit. They'd have you fucking barking like a dog.
Flying around like you're a fucking pigeon.
Looking ridiculous, okay? Or, I don't know if you know this, white people love making people sex slaves and shit.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're not a kinky sex family, dog.
Look, Jeffrey Dahmer was eating the shit out of niggas' heads, okay? But that was after he fucked their heads. Do you think they saw that shit coming? Hell no, okay?
And thanks for that image right there, man.
Hey, man, I ain't making this shit up. I saw on A&E, man.
It's real life.
Yo, and it's the black people out here, too. It's like all in Mr. Movement.
Because they probably hypnotized.
Now it's time for connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. Obviously, the things that they most have in common is that they're both horror movies. They're both horror movies kind of overtly about race, and they're both horror movies with comedic elements. But it feels like that they use all three of these things very differently from each other.
Yeah, I mean, there's more of a conceptual and an executional. There's more discipline to get out from a script level and from a level of performance and direction. I mean, it really has that. Inspired as The People Under the Stairs is, and I think the passage from Noel's review that we quoted in the last episode really gets it at how smart Craven's idea was for the film. I think just the execution of this idea in Get Out is just, it's sharper.
Yeah, part People Under Stairs, which I like, but establishes an allegorical setup, and then it just walks you through it over and over again until the movie's over. This is a subtler and a shiftier film in a way that I think makes it a little richer.
I mean, both of these movies are kind of about, specifically about white privilege and about white people using black bodies for their own gain. And neither one of them are subtle about it. They both state it openly to make sure you don't miss it. But at the same time, I don't know how much I feel inside Fool's experience in People Under the Stairs, in part because it feels so much more described than lived for the most part. Like that opening sequence with the tarot cards and a few moments that he has with his mother, that moment where he tells his mother, I'm going to buy you two Cadillacs, one for each foot, so you can go skating down the street and you'll look so good. Both of those are like very immersive moments where I actually felt like I was part of the scene of this family. But so much of the rest of the racial stuff in People Under the Stairs for me is more about having it described to me. You know, here is the mechanic by which you interact with people of another race, and it is bad. Whereas in Get Out, I felt so much more like locked into the discomfort of being there.
That's it. I don't want to pit one against the other, because I feel like People Under the Stairs is a really fun, visceral, sometimes literally visceral horror movie. And this is a different sort of horror movie. But I mean, People Under the Stairs has virtues of its own.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that they're not virtuous. I'm just kind of I'm looking at them in comparison via how they do the same things. I mean, if you want to get into what one does better than the other, People Under the Stairs has some really effective and well-designed gore. And Get Out kind of keeps that at a pretty low level throughout. I mean, they both have their strengths.
Yeah. I mean, Get Out is not as a horror film. It's not. Well, I don't think either film is particularly scary, but I don't think Get Out's strengths is as a straight up horror film. I think its strengths are conceptual and satirical, and People on the Stairs is maybe got more interest in delivering the goods in terms of just genre entertainment. One thing, though, you mentioned, I think, in the first part, Tasha, is the connection between Chris and Fool. I mean, they both go on a journey in this film, I think, in their respective films, and they both, you know, learn things about the world and learn things about themselves and how they can combat this situation that they're given and take action against their oppressors. So in that sense, the films do have something pretty strong in common.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, both are, in the words of that tarot sequence, about fools on journeys who, you know, they're not bad, they're just ignorant, and they have to find out what the world is really like, and then they have to learn to fight against it. And both of them are about kind of the boy burning away and learning to become a man. And I find it interesting that one of them is about a 13-year-old learning to become a man, which, I mean, he's told at the beginning of the film by Ving Rhames that he basically needs to. It doesn't matter that he's a child. He still needs to man up and help put money on the table. But Chris is much older.
His mother tells him that, too, if you remember. Yeah. Fool's mother tells him that he's the man of the house. Mm-hmm. And so he has to take on those responsibilities. I think the difference, though, between Chris and Fool is Chris does know what he's getting into to an extent. You know, he does feel queasy about going. He knows what these sorts of interactions are like, but I think he's used to navigating them in a certain way. And the situation calls for him to find a more confrontational and direct way of getting through.
Oh, sure. I mean, he basically learns that placating people will not keep him safe.
Yeah.
And, given that thought that Fool's mother is the one who tells him he's the man of the house now, he's got to be a man, I wonder then if it's significant that Chris doesn't seem to have quite learned or quite internalized that message yet. But he lost his mother when he was younger than Fool. Like, maybe he just didn't have somebody to tell him that. It's a pretty sobering and or depressing thought, much as that whole thing with his mother is a pretty sobering and or depressing plot line. How do you guys feel about the use of humor in Get Out is very overt. I mean, it's very Key and Peele. It's kind of confrontational and deliberate. There are like these little intervals of humor almost when Rod's talking. It feels like in People Under the Stairs, the humor is less naked and more kind of baked into the premise. How much do you think it's meant to be a comedy?
So I think with Get Out, Peele obviously, he knows humor. That's been established very well. But he's ever succumbing to the temptation to do a comedy that has horror elements. He's doing a horror film that has roots in satire and plays to his comedic strengths. But it's still ultimately a horror movie. And I think in People Under the Stairs, it feels like the horror is, you know, it's very broad. It is very over the top. But it's also used the way humor is often used in horror films, which is to diffuse the tension, at least temporarily, before things heat up again. You know, I think with Get Out, it's a little bit more of a hybrid where they're woven together a little more tightly.
Hmm. I kind of wanted to piggyback off a point that you made, too, about Rod and about certain points of the film where improvisation and riffing makes it seem like a different kind of comedy. Because the thing I really like about satire is that you really do have to be directed toward the conceit. The writing has to be directed towards that conceit. The humor has to be directed towards that conceit. And there's a sharpness to that that you wouldn't associate with some of Rod's comedy, I guess, or some of the riffing that goes on that maybe seems apart from what the rest of the film. And it was refreshing to me to get a comedy like Get Out or have the dark comedy elements of Get Out have this intentionality to them, not to be random, to be really hammering home real insight, which is what satire does and what disciplined comedy does. I mean, that's the thing that I really miss in modern comedy, which favors improvisers and performers and people who can think on their feet. I mean, all that stuff is great, but it doesn't necessarily make for more taught comedies or well-written comedies or make even the script all that relevant a document. Whereas the script in Get Out is exceptional and extremely important and something I think that the film by and large adheres to as it would a drama.
One of my many favorite things about Get Out is just a sense that the script has been worked over so intelligently that everything is intentional. And there were so many little moments where I came out of the film at the end thinking, I missed the intentionality of that because it didn't come up until later. But things like when Bradley Whitford says that the basement is closed off because they've got a problem with black mold. And it comes in the middle of this whole conversation about Jesse Owens and, you know, the strength of black athletes. And then when he suddenly mentions black mold, there's a deliberateness to that. There's a deliberateness to using that word. And part of it is because, you know, black mold is the poisonous kind, the dangerous, lethal kind. But part of it is just you're already primed to hear that word as a little bit of a threat. And you're already primed that every time this family mentions blackness, it's a little uncomfortable for some reason. And you see Chris sort of twitch a little at it. And it's like they dog whistle you with the word black in order to get past the fact that the basement is shut off because it's an impromptu evil surgery center. And you don't think about that until much, much later because it's just one of these things that you gloss across. I had the same reaction to when Whitford is introducing the two black servants. He says just really casually, we brought them in to take care of my parents. Mm-hmm. And then when my parents died, we couldn't let them go. The wording on that is very deliberate and very conscious.
Yeah, that hit me later too. That's a, yeah. It's a nice touch.
Keith, one of the connections you wanted to bring up was Power Games, and that definitely has a sense of Power Game about it. What were you thinking of with that topic?
Well, we talked about the gimp suit in People Under the Stairs, and you know, I don't know how deeply I want to go into sadomasochistic reading of either of these movies, but that definitely is a film in which who has the power and who doesn't and who's on top and who's not is keep shifting throughout the film. And with this, we get that a little bit as well, but I don't think Chris ever, until the very end of the movie, has any power in this movie as well. It puts him in one situation after another where he's completely powerless, either because of the authority of others over him, as with the cop, or the need to not upset his host. You know, the staying within the confines of polite society kind of keep him powerless as well. I think, as with all things, it's more overt in People Under the Stairs, but in some ways, some of the same dynamics are playing out here.
I guess I didn't think this through thoroughly, but now you've really got me thinking about it, and it just makes the movie more horrifying. There really isn't a whole lot of reason that they couldn't have just bashed him over the head the second he entered that house and taken him downstairs. The primary reason they don't is first so they can slowly set him up with a hypnosis process, but mostly because they need to introduce him to all of the people that'll be bidding on him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I hadn't really thought through the power games of that situation where they invite him in and try to make him welcome for an entire weekend. And it's just so the people who are going to be considering buying him can see him in action, can meet him socially, and can all interact with him. I talked at the very beginning of this about how part of the premise of Get Out is that this kind of like soft racism is as dangerous as overt racism. But when you look at what goes on in Get Out versus what goes on in People Under the Stairs, which does feature a couple of characters that are very overtly, nakedly racist, I'm a little torn at which one of them feels more dangerous.
Yeah, one character I really like in Get Out is the character played by Steven Root, who ultimately ends up purchasing Chris. And they have a moment before Chris is fully aware of what's going on where they kind of bond. They both love photography. Steven Root is a photographer turned art dealer who's lost his sight. And they really do seem to feel a connection to it. And you kind of get the sense that, I mean, he's a character who doesn't really go to great lengths to profess that he's not racist. And you get the sense that Chris kind of senses he isn't racist. And maybe he isn't, but you know, it's a condition of white privilege that ultimately, when it comes down to it, if you have something I want, I'm going to take it from you because I can. And that's what that character does. And that's one of the more interesting relationships in the film.
One thing that just sort of occurred to me is that both of these films kind of deal really uncomfortably. I mean, kind of the root of the horror in both cases is this idea of what's left over after you've taken what you want. You know, the People Under the Stairs are the leftovers from the Robesons taking in kids that they wanted to be perfect and finding that they weren't up to their standards, so they cut off some part of them and threw the rest of them in the basement. And you just kind of have these leftovers, you know, growing fouler and creepier down in the basement over time, the leftovers of that process. In the case of Get Out, the leftovers are the tiny remnants of personality left in these people who have been brain swapped and that come up in the most painful ways at the most inconvenient times, which the original Stepford Wives didn't have for fairly obvious reasons. The idea that your body has been stolen, but you're still down in there somewhere, I think is one of the most terrifying ideas that the film has among many of them.
Yeah, I mean, the moment when Lakeith Stanfield's character says the title line, and you know, this full-throated voice of his original personality is the only time it really gets to surface. It's a genuinely scary moment.
Yeah, that's a great moment in the movie for sure. And yeah, just imagining that fate of being forever in the sunken place until at that moment he snaps out of it. However briefly, it's just like it's such a big shock in a film that doesn't, you know, isn't that concerned with providing those kinds of shocks. I mean, I think it's okay being what it is. I don't think that Get Out tries terribly hard to be a horror film in any conventional sense. I mean, I think we identify it as such, and it has some scary moments and some atmospheric moments, but I think it just plays this scenario out and doesn't really try to create, you know, the kind of jump scares or the things you might expect from this kind of a horror film.
I mean, there are a fair number of jump scares in Get Out. Like, there's the deer hitting the car. There's the housekeeper suddenly walking by in, like, Exorcist 3 style, like, deep in the back of the frame with the stabbing music. There's the whole opening sequence. Like, Get Out does
a little bit.
All right. Get into it.
Yeah, I do see it first and foremost as a horror film, no matter what else is going on. And I think it really is still rooted in that tradition.
Yeah, I guess maybe it just didn't seem as, you know, forced or formulaic or trying to conform to what you might expect from a modern studio horror film, you know, because we see so many of those and they all look alike.
So what you're saying is it's a good horror film.
It's a good film, yeah. So it's not horror. if that was coming from somebody else, Scott.
No, that just makes me sound stupid.
No.
It's possible.
But
this isn't a horror film. This isn't the Bye Bye Man.
Yeah, that's right.
The thing, Scott. Earlier when we were kind of tweaking the script a little bit, you suggested describing both of these films as satire. Do you see Get Out more as a satire than a horror film?
Yeah, I do. I would, you know, I mean, it's a hybrid. I mean, I would call it a horror satire, a satirical horror film or something. I see it as a hybrid of both pretty equally.
But I mean, if People Under the Stairs is specifically satiring the Reagans and Reagan America, what is this satirizing?
It's satirizing race in America, I suppose, to put it broadly. I think that's probably about right. In church, you know, certainly for the first half, especially, you know, satirizing a very specific type of you know, white liberal elite. And I mean, that's a really interesting target. It's a Boonwellian impulse to satirize this type of family, right? I mean, a bourgeois family. I mean, I think this is a movie that Boonwell would have appreciated. It has that kind of a super strong conceit, and it goes after people who would actually be the audience for the movie sometimes, right?
Oh, that's fascinating. I see so many touchstones in Get Out. I mean, obviously there's the Stepford Wives. There's the original Wicker Man, you know, somebody lured into a conspiracy and trying to figure out what the conspiracy is. You know, there are a bunch of like horror films, and People Under the Stairs feels like a touchstone. It had not occurred to me to see Buñuel in there, but now that you mention it, I mean, it does feel a little of a piece with movies like Exterminating Angel. They're kind of deliberately laughing at the bourgeois, you know, at the upper crust and their pretensions. That's a really interesting thought.
Yep. And I just threw it in there. You know, it's like a Hail Mary pass at the end of our connection segment.
Yeah, we should mention also, we did consider pairing the Stepford Wives with this. It's an obvious inspiration. Peele has touched on it as such, but it was almost too big a spoiler to have that as our episode title, so we want something a little less obvious. It's worth seeking out. This is, I think, more successful ultimately, but I really like Stepford Wives. It's another film that plays very broad satire, but also finds some really unsettling horror underneath that satire. For those of you who don't know, it's a film in which Catherine Ross plays a feminist inclined woman who is moves to the suburbs and discovers that all the women around her are just a little too perfect and a little too eager to please their men, and it's a horrible bargain where they've been replaced by robots. It's very much worth seeking out. But again, it's funny and everything's very big, but it's also really unsettling, the idea of being replaced by a machine, that these men could live with machines and find that preferable. It's very much a good companion piece.
It's also an interesting just point of comparison when people, because there are people who have seen Get Out or at least heard about Get Out who are calling the film racist, you know, because there are no good white people in it. And I can't help but wonder if people saw Stepford Wives and said this movie is incredibly sexist because not all men, you know, I wonder if the same people would have been offended in the same way, because the movie is in the same way speaking to its era and speaking to this idea of like, this is what it feels like to be a woman right now, is to have this constant uncomfortable pressure that you're not doing it right, and like you're disrupting the social order by having opinions and ideas of your own. Maybe if you shut up and were like our imaginary version of you in the 50s, society would run smoothly.
This movie's so dated. Except for once, it's so dated, right?
I mean, you know, I've been kind of avoiding a lot of Get Out takes. Are there really people in print saying this thing is a racist movie?
A critic who shan't be named for a publication called the National Review. The first to weigh in, but some, I suspected, some of the Fox News crowd kind of picked up on it and responded unfavorably. Our friend Alan Scherstel at the Village Voice was criticized for his opinion in a publication. What's it called? The Daily Stormer, I believe it's what it's called.
it's a Nazi
publication. He was posting screenshots of that earlier today. So.
I thought he was posting to it.
No.
It's like, Alan, man, don't poke the hive.
No.
There's also been a few articles out there that are doing the usual, like, can we find a contrarian on social media somewhere that tweeted or Facebooked an adverse reaction? I mean, this film has been universally praised by critics, more or less, by mainstream critics, regardless of walks of life. It's got 100% last we checked on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, and I knew when that was being passed around, I'm like, oh boy, you may as well put a big target on this movie for someone.
Also, I think everyone was waiting for Armand White, who delivered as promised. But
it is now at 99%.
Because Armand White spoke up?
Possibly, right. I don't know.
And there's also I did read a fairly ridiculous Newsweek piece, which wouldn't be ridiculous in a different context. It was saying, well, it's got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, but Rotten Tomatoes just registers positive and negative opinions about films, not how positive and how negative you are about a film. And I've had that complaint about Rotten Tomatoes forever, but I would not want to make it in reference to Get Out. It's like, why now and why in reference to that film? Do you have to say, wait, people are not as enthusiastic as they seem because everyone at least likes it?
Maybe it's because of some sort of, you know, deep-seated buried racism and the liberal white elites that have taken over everything.
It couldn't be that.
Oh, you're right. It couldn't be that. Let's just self-congratulate us. We fixed racism, guys.
You did a great job.
We're pretty cool. As white people, we're pretty cool that this movie's cooler. You can find The People Under the Stairs on DVD and Blu-ray. You can find it streaming for rental on the usual services. Meanwhile, Get Out is doing tremendously well in theaters and will hopefully be there for a while to come. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Keith, kick us off. What has been good for you lately?
Good. I don't know. This is a movie that if I had a chance to rate it on Letterboxd with what I wanted, I'd probably give it like 5 question marks. but I wanted to go see A Cure for Wellness, which is Gore Verbinski's new movie, because I'd heard interesting things about it. I think Verbinski is a very skilled director. Verbinski is the guy who directed the remake of The Ring. He directed Rango, the animated film, the first 3 Pirates of the Caribbean, Lone Ranger. He knows his way around a camera. He knows how to create atmosphere and stage a set piece. And this was a film that I don't know how it got made and released by a major studio, and I'm glad it did. It's the oddest thing. It's Dane DeHaan plays a very young Wall Street trader who has created some sort of impropriety, and as punishment is sent by his firm to track down their CEO, who has written a strange letter and disappeared into the depths of this Swiss old style clinic that are situated over these healing springs. And what follows is filled with like sort of early 20th century, mid 20th century medical devicery in very creepy ways, which I appreciated. But it's almost more like a big budget version of a Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe adaptation, which is this super gothed out horror movie with all kinds of unsettling details and this plot that gets more disturbing and twisted as it goes along to the point of a finale, which is very strange and crosses all kinds of lines I can't believe actually got through the MPAA rating system in a way that was able to be released. You know, I don't think it's a perfect movie. I think it's flawed in some really interesting ways, but I was never bored, even though it's 2.5 hours long. I don't know. I recommend seeing it in theaters if it's even anywhere and still playing by the time this is released. But it's definitely a curiosity worth seeking out.
That's the sneaky thing about this time of year, the dregs of January and February, is that you get some misfits, and those misfits are often pretty compelling because they don't they're not the sorts of movies that studios are supposed to be putting out, especially, you know, in a system that feels like it has so much under control right now.
Yeah, and there's some, there's just on a purely just visual level, there are some shots in these movies that, you know, are just stunning, and some just conceits that are quite disturbing. And I don't know, I think everyone in this room at least would appreciate it. And I'm sure if you're a fan of this podcast, probably tuned enough to our sensibilities to want to seek it out as well.
Yeah, I saw the trailer for that thing and I thought that looks like 90% pure Toshnip and 10% Sucker Punch. And I wasn't sure which way the balance was eventually going to fall on the actual movie. I'm still really curious. I want
to
see it.
A little bit of Sucker Punchiness to it. But really, I mean, I do think it is like those Poe films that Roger Corman made, right down to the sort of, we're going to aggressively use this one color scheme to the point where you'll think the whole world is built around these shades of different colors. I don't know.
You're killing me with these Poe Corman comparisons.
You dig it, man. Tasha, how about you?
While we're talking about horror films with black protagonists, and which now that I think about it just seems a little subversive in and of itself because of the long established the black person dies first trope in horror movies, which, by the way, if you look up on TV tropes, there's quite a long and entertaining list of those. And it depresses me that it's such a thing. But that makes it all the more subversive, I guess, when you have a horror film with a black protagonist. And particularly when such a thing as blackwashing in film. There is a movie called The Girl with All the Gifts that is playing an extremely limited release, but it was also day and date released on streaming on demand. You can rent it online all over the place. It's based on a horror novel by Mike Carey, who is an author I'm extremely fond of, and I loved this book. He published it under the name M.R. Carey, I think, to keep it from getting confused with all of the other things he was doing in comics and writing kind of hard-boiled supernatural detective fiction as Mike Carey. But M.R. Carey has only written a couple of books, and they're both spectacular. And it's really hard to know what I can say about this movie that wouldn't be giving away things that I don't want to give away. This is another film slash book that I think you best go into with absolutely no idea where it goes, because the lead-up is so brilliant and there's so much going on in it where you don't know what's going on. I guess I can start by saying the protagonist of the film is a young black girl who's being kept in some sort of institution, and figuring out what that institution is and what the rules are and why it operates the way it does is a huge discovery. But it is a horror film. In the book, the main character was white, and the teacher, that is the only person in her life and in the institution who cares about her on a human level, is black. The makers of the film decided to swap those two characters. So the protagonist is played by a little girl named Senia Nawa, and she is just, she's spectacular. She's such a bright spot. Films with child protagonists can be very difficult if they're not pitched right. She did give such an amazing performance in a pretty demanding role, and the people around her make a very convincing small cast of characters for a horror survival situation. So I honestly, if you like horror, and if you think certain horror genres have been played out, but you're still open to them, I would strongly recommend not watching a trailer and just sitting down to this movie.
Yeah. Did you write about this movie?
I don't believe I did. I think I talked about it a little. I saw it at TIFF, and then I came back and talked a little bit about it. But, you know, it's just now available for broad release.
Yeah, I wrote about it. And much as you said, I said you're probably better off not knowing too much about this movie going into it. And then I realized I had to write the rest of my review. So I had to reveal a little bit. So I'll just say that it does participate in a very familiar genre. I feel like the middle of this movie is just doesn't really show me anything in that genre I haven't seen before. But the bookends of this are really sharp. I like this movie a lot. And the cast beyond the lead is Glenn Close and Patty Considine and Jim Arterton. So there's no scrubs in this movie. That's a very well cast movie. I like this movie a lot. I'm glad this was my second pick. And so I'm glad you mentioned it.
Absolutely. Scott, what do you have for us?
This is one of my favorite times of year, not only because you get quirky little films you don't expect, like Get Out and perhaps A Cure for Wellness, but also I can just do whatever I want. You know, I'm not catching up with end of the year films like in a mad scramble like I am every year. There's not a whole lot of essential things to see in theaters, and so this is going to be another edition of Scott's Adventures on Filmstruck. I've been turning once again to Filmstruck in my free time, specifically a series of film noir and westerns directed by Anthony Mann and photographed by John Alton. If you ever saw the documentary Visions of Light, you'll probably remember that Alton was heavily featured as a paragon of noir style, where most studios at the time were doing a lot of lighting from the ceiling. Alton was setting up his lights on the floor and working very quickly and working hard to hide information as much as he was in revealing information. I've seen three of the films so far. T-Men, which is about Treasury agents working to bust counterfeiters. Raw Deal, which is about an inmate who's broken out of prison for nefarious reasons. And He Walked by Night, which is about a killer on the streets of Los Angeles and is a big influence on Dragnet. All of them are quite good, especially Raw Deal, which has a really unusual love triangle at the center of it. But the star attraction for me is Alton's images, which are graphically stunning and consistently imaginative. There's a sequence at the end of He Walked by Night in the drain tunnels of L.A. that not only predates The Third Man, but I think truly rivals its beauty. So if you really like film noir style and black and white and hard shadows and graphically interesting images, I mean, for that alone, these films are worth seeing, quite apart from their content, which is also, I think, compelling, especially Raw Deal. I mean, just in terms of actually both parts of the film working really well, Raw Deal is just a truly great noir. So I'd recommend that. And then there are a couple other films that are both Westerns that are also included in this kind of five film package that they have up on Filmstruck now. Anthony Mann, John Alton.
Fantastic. Keith, are you familiar at all?
I'm familiar with Anthony Mann, but I've not seen those movies. And I've actually had them on my list of things to see for a long time, and I have a Filmstruck subscription.
They're now, nice and short, too. That's the nice thing. It's just like, boom, I can watch it. Like, Raw Deal, I think, is an hour and 20
that's
minutes.
That's just it. That's perfect. Then I'm looking for short is good. Short is good. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. That makes me more inclined to seek them out soon.
Exactly.
Well, watch them soon, because as we're recording this, we're just about to be out of February. And by the time this airs, we'll be into March, and you'll be running shorter and shorter of time as more and more actual films that we're all supposed to see come out. But in the meantime, thanks for those recommendations, guys. I'm sure they will be particularly meaningful to people who are wading through the gigantic sea of content that is Filmstruck and looking for a little direction.
Seriously, yeah. It's an embarrassment of riches.
And that's it for this week's edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out March 21 and 23. Scott, what do we have lined up?
Well, with Kong Skull Island stampeding into theaters, we want to go all the way back to its origins, not only of King Kong, but of big screen spectacle itself, with a 1933 production with Fay Wray and a giant gorilla. The film remains a standard bearer that many other films have revisited since, from the 1976 Dino De Laurentiis production with Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange to the three-hour Peter Jackson version from 2005. Perhaps every era gets the King Kong it deserves, but we thought it would be a good time to reflect on what the 1933 Kong and what the 2017 Kong say about their respective eras.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of The People Under the Stairs and Get Out, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Scott?
Well, you can find me at so many different places. You can find me at the New York Times. You can find me at Washington Post, NPR, Vulture, Variety, Uproxx, Guardian, other places like that. I'm also the editor-in-chief of Oscilloscope's Musings blog. And I'm on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias.
I made a nice cameo appearance at Musings a few weeks ago. Thanks, Scott. But mostly I'm at Uproxx.com, where I serve as editorial director of film and television.
You can find me at TheVerge.com writing about film and TV, occasionally books, although more and more I'm doing behind-the-scenes editorial stuff and enjoying that. You can also find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show via Twitter at Next Picture Pod and via Facebook at Facebook.com/Next Picture Show. If you have not already rated us on iTunes, please consider subscribing there and giving us some kind of rating or review, because every thumbs up you give us helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks to Colin the Animal Griffith for his assistance in producing the show, and thanks to Delmark Records for providing recording space at their home base of Riverside Studios. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time.